Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Healthcare is the business of healing people. Unfortunately, sometimes the business of healthcare causes harm. One area in which this had largely been true was environmental management. Healthcare facilities routinely use products that become biohazards because they've been exposed to blood or other infectious material. And the standard practice of disposal was incineration. The downside of burning hospital waste is that it's loaded with plastics that contain chemicals like dioxin, which are toxic and persist in the environment. My guest today, Gary Cohen, and the organization that he co-founded, Healthcare Without Harm, started as a small grassroots organization and now has offices on four continents and a consortium of other advocacy and research organizations either under its umbrella or affiliated in mission. Cohen has spent his career working to ameliorate poor environmental practices in healthcare, such as incineration. He's been recognized for his work. Last September, he was named a MacArthur Fellow, the so-called Genius Grant. Gary Cohen, president of Healthcare Without Harm, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa on Health. Gary Cohen, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start by asking you really about one of the best stories of Healthcare Without Harm, which is the dioxin story. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So in the mid-1990s, we were learning that the way that we thought about chemicals and people's health was changing. And we were learning that very, very low doses of toxic chemicals in the womb, for children in the womb and in the first couple of years of life, were very significant for leading to potential negative health impacts later in life. Because the child is so vulnerable and there's different systems of the body that are developing, it really wasn't the dose that made the poison, it was the timing. And so at that very same time, the Environmental Protection Agency was reporting that medical waste incineration was the largest source of dioxin emissions in the United States. And dioxin is a byproduct of burning chlorinated plastics, chlorinated waste. And it's a very nasty chemical byproduct that is linked to cancer and learning disabilities and birth defects and endometriosis and other health impacts. And so the idea that hospitals were the largest source of this poisonous chemical emission was so against their mission. It was the impetus to start Healthcare Without Harm, to say, look, we need to bring an environmental health framework to the healthcare sector and help them clean up their own house, help them clean up their hospitals, help them clean up their clinics. And so that was the impetus for it.
And you were successful in doing that, as you point out, because it was central to the mission of hospitals, really, and I guess other healthcare organizations, since their main goal is to provide health, not to harm people through harming the environment. So I read in some of the literature that you didn't really have to do it by legislative fiat. It was sort of there was buy-in from the organizations that you were able to kind of present yourselves to.
Well, certainly hospitals can't be poisoning people in service of healing them. So the mission contradiction was an important factor in getting the hospitals to change. But the other factors were important as well, which was that there were available alternatives to manage waste. They could reduce the amount of waste. They could recycle some of the materials just like people do in their homes. There was so that the amount of waste that we're concerned about, infectious waste, was a much smaller percentage. And that there was technologies called autoclave, which are basically a steam sterilization technology that can render that infectious waste inert and kill the pathogens, and then it could be buried. So you reduce the volume, and then you use alternative technologies, and it turns out that that strategy also saved the hospitals lots of money. So then you had available alternatives, saving money, mission aligned, and so it led from when we started, there were about 4,500 medical waste incinerators in the country, and a decade later, there were maybe 70.
That's an incredible story. I mean, just the fact that, so you, I mean, circled back to these hospitals or these medical waste incinerators and they literally have just, had padlocks on them or were shut down? I mean, that was it?
They were shut down and the hospitals employed these alternative treatment technologies and many of them have started reducing and recycling what's possible to be done. So it's more than just a technology solution. It's a different way of thinking about the things that come into the front door of the hospital and how do you manage them.
That does make a lot of sense, certainly, for reusing materials. But one of the ideas that came up in some of the reading I did was that, for example, IV bags and IV tubing, which are plastics, are those getting recycled too, or are those seem to be like single-use items that often have to get, I guess previously were incinerated and are now just, are they put in a landfill somewhere, or what happens with those?
Yeah, I mean, some of them, so there's some plastics that are more recyclable than others, like bottles and some hard plastics. Things that come in contact with the patient, though, they're not generally recycled. Many of those IV bags are made of PVC, which is not particularly recyclable. So those are, put into autoclaves and rendered inert, and then they're buried or they're sent to landfills. Some of them, though, still may be sent to sort of commercial incinerators, but less so.
So another of the very positive stories of healthcare without harm is really the diminishment, or in fact, the outright cessation of use of mercury. And mercury was something that was fairly ubiquitous, and we think of mercury thermometers. Tell us what you did there.
It was a similar story. I mean, there were so many millions of mercury thermometers that were breaking in hospitals and people's homes and winding up in our water supply, and then in many cases winding up in the fish that we eat. And at the very same time that we were starting to work on this, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta was reporting that kids were being born with mercury in their bodies, in some cases enough mercury that could cause learning disabilities later in life, because we know that mercury is damaging to the brains of people, in particular, again, the developing child, which is why sometimes pregnant women are advised not to eat fish that are high on the food chain, like tuna and shark, because it's higher levels of mercury. So we were able to say that there were alternatives on the market, digital alternatives, other alternatives to mercury thermometers, and again show that they performed just as well as the mercury thermometers, and they didn't break in the same way. And so, and if they did break, you didn't have this huge hazardous waste problem where you had to, many hospitals, they had these hazmat teams, and they had to train people on how to deal with mercury spills and all of this complicated, expensive stuff. And so, again, the business case worked for the alternatives. We were able to convince initially one hospital in Boston, where I live, to switch out of mercury thermometers and even give digital ones to their employees as an inducement and to some of the community people. And then we convinced the rest of the hospitals in Boston to follow their example, and then went to a number of cities and convinced the hospitals in those cities, and then partnered with the American Hospital Association and the Environmental Protection Agency to get over 5,000 hospitals to commit to go mercury-free. And then we got all the pharmacy chains to stop selling mercury thermometers, because people also were breaking them in their homes, and that was a problem. So without really any federal legislation, the market for mercury-based measuring devices, thermometers, and blood pressure devices was eliminated over the course of about a 10-15 year period. And then in Europe, we passed legislation that affected the whole European Union, and then partnered with the World Health Organization to kind of launch a campaign to eliminate mercury all around the globe. And so about a year and a half ago, there was a global treaty passed on mercury called the Minamata Treaty, which phases out all mercury measuring devices by the year 2020.
That's just an amazing story of community activism, really, and then getting the ball rolling and gaining momentum. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Gary Cohen, who's co-founder and president of the organization Healthcare Without Harm. He was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in September 2015. Gary Cohen, one of the things that's, you told us the story about dioxin and mercury and the steep drop in the number of medical incinerators and really pretty much the outright disuse of mercury. Your organization is an international consortia. So how did you succeed, in terms of organization, getting so many international groups to play along with you?
Well, the idea of healthcare being environmentally responsible is a compelling idea whose time has come. So when you think about the mission of healthcare, it's to heal people. And as we learn more and more that the environment that we live in, the food that we eat, the air pollution that we may be exposed to, the water contamination that we may face has a huge impact on our health. It makes sense that the healthcare sector should lead the rest of society in creating health in our communities and on the planet. And so it's the one sector of the economy that has health and healing as its core mission and has an ethical framework. And so it makes sense that a lot of people will be compelled by that vision, people that came into healthcare to say, yeah, I came in because I wanted to heal people. I wanted to make people better. And in order to do that, we really need to move upstream. We need to move outside the walls of our hospitals and clinics to address the environmental conditions and social conditions that people face in their communities that are making them sick in the first place.
So say a little bit more about that, about the social conditions or moving upstream. You have pivoted a little bit, or maybe that's maybe expanded is the better word. You have different, I don't know if you call them different organizations or brand names, but for example, there's Practice Green Health. What are some of the organizations and what are their different emphases?
Well, so Healthcare Without Harm is kind of a research and development and an advocacy organization. So we identify issues that we think the hospital systems, healthcare needs to deal with, like safer chemicals in their facilities and reducing their energy use and moving to a renewable energy. And we'll pilot those solutions with a few leading hospital systems to show how it can be done and to make the business case and to build models. And then we created a membership organization in the United States called Practice Green Health that has about 1,300 hospital members. And that's the vehicle that we use to scale it, to create a much broader adoption of those solutions. So it's a way of socializing it among a lot of different systems that they can learn from each other, they can share their practices together, and they can transform healthcare. Internationally, we've either built or partnered with lots of different organizations around the world that share our mission for transforming healthcare to be environmentally responsible. And in a few places around the world, we've built actual Healthcare Without Harm organizations. So there's one in Europe based in Brussels. There's one in Latin America based in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And there's one in the Philippines based in Manila. And out of those offices, we also have built the same kind of partnerships in those regions with healthcare institutions and public health organizations to build an ecosystem, because no one organization is going to change the world, no matter how big. You need coalitions, you need partnerships, you need to build a whole ecosystem of change agents.
So one of the areas that Healthcare Without Harm is now addressing, well, there's a couple I wanted to ask you about. One in particular is this issue of climate change. And I saw, I think, in one of your videos that you want hospitals to really be, how should we say it, the fortress for when the time comes in either a natural disaster or a weather-related catastrophe, that the hospital is left standing as sort of a beacon or a symbol of hope and healing. So that has a lot to do with construction, but of course how the hospital frames its interactions with the environment. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. One of the powerful and tragic lessons of Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy is that some of the hospitals in New Orleans and New York failed. They lost power. The backup generators were in the basement. They got flooded. The electrical equipment stopped working, and they had to be evacuated. And so at the very moment when a city is in trauma and experiencing all sorts of dislocation because of extreme weather events, you need the hospital to operate. And here's the hospitals actually evacuating people. So how do we solve that problem? And Oklahoma, Texas, many, many states are facing increasing extreme weather events. And in those extreme events, we need the hospital to be the last building standing so they can take additional people that are injured. So what we've learned from those situations, those disasters, that when hospitals have on-site power and the grid goes down, the electrical grid goes down, they can still operate. And so there were several hospitals in the New York area that continued to operate, even though Hurricane Sandy had basically wiped out most of Manhattan, because they had on-site power. They had what's called cogeneration, so they were able to take the waste heat and run turbine off of the waste heat, so they continued to create energy sometimes for 5 to 10 days. So that kind of technology, such an obvious no-brainer for hospitals all around the country, because A, it is more efficient, so you reduce your greenhouse gas emissions. B, it allows you to be resilient in the face of climate change or extreme weather events. And C, it saves you money. So like every hospital in America should be figuring out how to install on-site power and other strategies so they can continue to operate in the face of the coming storms of climate change.
So is it using co-generated power as their primary means of power generation, or only in the event of a interruption in the grid, or is it both? I mean, a hospital can choose.
Yeah, it's both. I mean, they might be on natural gas, and basically it makes the natural gas more efficient because the natural gas will be powering the facility, but there's all sorts of waste heat that's coming off of hospitals because of cooling and heating and all that. It's capturing that waste heat and then turning it into more energy as opposed to just letting it vent. There are fuel cells, new technologies that could run the hospital, and then you can have cogeneration. There's also solar and wind that hospitals can switch to. So, for example, there was the town of Greensburg, Kansas, was pretty much wiped out by a tornado a few years ago. And they rebuilt the town and they rebuilt the hospital purely on wind power with wind turbines, which are just more likely to be resilient to extreme weather events than traditional grid. So I think we're seeing more of that kind of investment in on-site power or investing in solar fields or wind power to make this transition to more renewable energy sources.
So I think there the question of cost pops up. I mean, you suggested that it's ultimately a cost savings for those hospitals, but I imagine there's got to be a fair bit of investment to convert to, you know, different systems. So that's got to be a more difficult hurdle to overcome than getting rid of mercury thermometers, where there was a, you know, pretty widely accepted alternative.
Yeah, it is a hurdle. There's some really creative financing solutions that are out there nowadays, where banks and others will come in and say, look, we will finance the renewable energy project, and we will, if there's a tax credit, in some states there's tax credits, we'll take the tax credit for it, and you as the hospital have to agree to basically pay a certain price for the energy that's generated over a 20-year period. And so they get the energy without putting up money up front. And so it's called a power purchase agreement. And so there's a number of those versions of that kind of power purchase agreement that are popping up all over the country that address this issue of hospitals not having a lot of money to make capital investments. Some hospitals are making those capital investments because they see over the life of the project, they'll get a good return on investment. So, for example, there's a hospital in Wisconsin called Gunderson Health System and in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and they invested $2 million in a whole suite of energy efficiency strategies. And their estimate is that every year they save $1 million. So you make a $2 million investment, within 2 years you've got it paid back, and then every year you're saving $1 million. That's a good investment.
That does sound like a good investment. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Gary Cohen, who's the co-founder and the president of Healthcare Without Harm. And we've been talking about issues like dioxin and mercury in the environment and reducing those toxins. We also covered climate change. Gary, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is I noticed a recent article from NPR, our parent network, on more hospitals, quote-unquote, ditching antibiotics in the meat they serve. So it seems like your organization has also had a role here, essentially hospitals trying to provide, I guess, the safest type of food to their patients, again, leading the way in society. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's the same issue that we think that if hospitals are about health and healing, they shouldn't be serving junk food and poor food in their cafeterias or buying it for their patients, right? We want hospitals to model healthy food environments. They want hospitals to educate their patients about how they can better quicker, how they can stay healthy. I mean, we have this enormous epidemic of obesity and diabetes and other food-related diseases in our society. A lot of it has to do with the food system, and so we want to create an easier way for people to eat healthier. And so we've done a lot of stuff about a lot of work around hospitals, supporting farmers markets in their hospitals or in their grounds, supporting more local and sustainable agriculture that provides guaranteed markets for those farmers, more organic food, and in the area that you mentioned, in the area of meat, we've been really concerned with, and everybody's concerned with, the issue of antibiotic resistance. In other words, germs that are resistant to the antibiotics that we all take when we have bacterial infections. And the irony is that out of all the antibiotics that are produced in the country, manufactured, almost 80% of them are used in animal agriculture, and only 20% of them are used in human medicine. And because of the overuse of antibiotics in animal agriculture, it's creating more resistance in the population and in the environment. And so antibiotics is one of the critical tools that medicine has. And if you come in with a bacterial infection and your antibiotic doesn't work, it's a serious thing. You could die from that. And so we want to preserve antibiotics for human medicine and not for animal agriculture, because we think there are better ways of addressing infections in animal agriculture in terms of the way that you raise the animals. So we've been encouraging hospitals, and they've been following suit, to changing their purchasing practices to buy meat produced without the therapeutic use of antibiotics in animal agriculture, and starting to change the market. We're not the only ones working on this. I mean, McDonald's is agreeing to this kind of strategy. Many others are agreeing to this because there's a real global concern with antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, and you're right. I think it points out that it's something consumers seem to want more and more. So it certainly does make sense for healthcare enterprises to lead the way. Gary, I want to shift gears a bit and just ask a little bit about you and your background. And it sounds like you know a lot about toxicology. How did you come to co-found Healthcare Without Harm, and how did you develop your career in this direction?
Well, in a roundabout way, like many people in their professions, my first job out of college was writing guidebooks to Paris and London and other places, and had nothing to do with any of these issues. And when I was in London, and when I came back to the United States, a good friend of mine had gotten involved in supporting communities who were impacted by toxic chemical threats. A factory down the street that's polluting them, or they live in an incinerator, or there's water contamination, all those kinds of issues. And so he said, could you write a guidebook to toxics? And I said, look, nobody really wants to visit those places. Said, no, this is a guidebook for people who live in polluted places to help them address their problems. So how do they organize their neighbors? How do they use the media? How do they hire lawyers or not? How do they talk to the companies that are at fault? And so I said, well, I don't know anything about it, but he said, you don't have to. I'll introduce you to people around the country, all around the country, who are working on these issues, Superfund sites, this whole kind of set of problems. And so I started meeting people, and they were mothers and fathers that were sitting around kitchen tables trying to figure out why their kids were sick and why the water tasted bad and why their kids woke up gasping for air at night. And I was inspired by their tenacity and their defense of their children and their health. And I got involved in these issues and started working with this organization that was trying to provide help to community-level struggles around pollution. And then it was in the mid-90s then when I learned about these problems in the healthcare sector and pollution. I said, look, how are we going to change society if the institution that's committed to healing is itself part of the problem? We've got to change healthcare. We've got to educate healthcare about the essential connections between the environment and people's health, and that'll have a knock-on effect to change the rest of our society. And so that's the long way in which I came to healthcare with Harman. That's 30 years ago now.
So like a lot of stories, it was a good friend that kind of got you into the field.
Yeah, in a totally roundabout way.
Well, so could you have ever envisioned being named a MacArthur Fellow? Did you have any inkling that that was going to happen last September?
No, it was quite a surprise and a wonderful opportunity. I mean, the irony is that I met the woman who ran the program of the MacArthur Fellows program about 6 months earlier at a conference in Oxford, and she had Oxford, England. She just sat down next to me. I was sitting somewhere. She came and sat down next to me, and I just started having a conversation. I didn't know who she was, and she was asking me about myself and why I was at this conference, etc. And it was about 20 minutes into the conversation, I said, well, what do you do? And she said, oh, I run the MacArthur Fellows Program, the MacArthur Foundation. I said, oh, well, that's interesting. And so I said to her, I've noticed in the list of awardees, there's not very many people who have been involved in environmental health issues. She said, no, we really haven't covered that. I said, well, there's a lot of good people out there that have been sort of building this movement over the last 30 years. You should think about that as a category. And she said, oh, Dad, thanks for the advice. And then it was the same woman, Cecilia Conrad, who called me a couple of months ago to tell me I won the award. And she said, I intentionally sat down next to you.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, so, we were checking you out. We had you on our sights.
So it was almost as you didn't know who she was, and she was scouting. She was doing a
exactly.
scouting mission.
She was scouting me out.
Oh, what a great story.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Gary Cohn, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Congratulations on all the work, the recognition, the MacArthur Fellowship. I guess one question people often ask you is, what will you, you know, now that you are a MacArthur Genius Grant winner, as it's often called, how will you use the prize to further your efforts?
It's a good question. I mean, we just put solar panels on our house, so that was the first step. And then I'm also thinking of taking a sabbatical with my wife to Europe in the fall. She and my daughter have both suffered in a way because of all the travel I've done and how much work it's taken to build this organization. And so part of it, I want to support them and spend money on them, and some of it will actually go into the work, because I think we're going to be developing some really exciting new initiatives to continue to accelerate the momentum of sustainable healthcare around the world.
Very nice. Well, Gary Cohn, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Gary Cohn is the co-founder and president of Healthcare Without Harm and was recently named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. Gary Cohn is the co-founder and president of Healthcare Without Harm. He was named a MacArthur Fellow in September 2015. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you want to listen anytime to any of our programs, you can stream them online by going to our website, studiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.